Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog Live here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell. Every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern, we have a really awesome guest tonight. It's just the boys are off. It's just going to be me and the guest tonight. But before we get started and we delve into all that, make sure to go to Facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish and go check out some authentic Vedic astrology. I'm telling you guys saw the episode we did with Neil John. The guy's incredible. His work is incredible. You're going to love it. It's great. Great stuff. I got a whole reading. It blew my mind. I'm usually pretty like critical of this kind of goofy stuff. I thought astrology and horoscopes was all just dumb. And then I got this reading from Neil John. I was blown away. I'm telling you guys, it's really, really cool. Great work. So go to Facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish. If you decide to get your own reading, make sure to tell them Big Dave sent you. Tell them Big Dave sent you. But if you like The Bog, you support The Bog, you want to see The Bog grow, make sure to go to Patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody. $5 all the way up to $50. All kinds of cool stuff over there. Exclusive content as well as an RSS feed so you can get audio of every single show that we do to listen to at the work, on your commutes, at gym, wherever you are. If you want to listen to the audio of The Bog and all the exclusive content we do, go to patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. If you want to support The Bog another way, go to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop and go check out some of the sweet merch we got over there. We got t-shirts, hats, backpacks, artisan chef aprons, beanies, you know, all kinds of stuff. Whatever you want. Man, summertime's coming. Ladies, we got nice summer dresses with The Bog logo. So if you want to tell everybody that you're rocking The Bog, that you're one of the Bog Lords or Bog Maidens and you support The Bog, go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop. All right, without further ado, tonight I have a really, really cool guest. He is a contributor over at an up-and-coming pagan outlet that does a lot of scholarship and does a lot of really, really cool work. They're called the Sunriders, and they are on Telegram. So if you want to check them out, I believe it's t.me/solarcult, I believe is the thing. I'll have it in the description when I upload this on YouTube. So with us tonight, we have one of the contributors from the Sunriders who specializes in Celtic myths as well as Indo-European comparative studies. How you doing tonight, Mr. O'Gravy?
I'm doing well. Thanks for inviting me on.
My pleasure, sir. Long time coming. So I love the Sunriders. I think the Sunriders are they're like in my top five favorite outlets out there. And I kind of came across Sunriders about like a year ago or something, and I was reading some of the early stuff that you guys were doing, and I was like, this is a cut above the rest. Like, there's like a handful of folks out there that are doing pagan content and that are scholars and are kind of redefining what scholarship is in regards to ancestral European religion that I really, really love, that I think are like above the rest. And I think that you guys, when I saw some of your guys' articles and the kind of content that you were writing, I was like, these guys get it. This is legitimate content. So for folks out there that maybe they don't have Telegram or they're unfamiliar with the Sunriders, can you tell us what the Sunriders are?
All right. Well, thanks for those nice words. And yeah, it's just kind of been a group of guys that we've kind of built up a small community starting on Discord and other platforms where we would just discuss these things like you do. And the ball just kind of got rolling, and we started putting ideas together and trying to come up with articles and things we could research and just kind of sharing information. And we are basically focused around just general Indo-European you know, paganism and mythology and culture and all the things connected to that. You know, really just there are people from every branch, every European branch, essentially, that contribute and are in our discussion room and all that sort of thing. And yeah, it's a little bit broad because of that. Just a lot of people going in different directions, which, you know, there are a lot of great groups that are Germanic specific and that sort of thing. You see, you know, like your guys' group is really great because you can really focus in on that. And our thing has just kind of been a lot more a little bit all over the place, you know, a lot of, you know, sure. just ancient history and seeing how the different branches relate to each other and that sort of thing. Yeah. Which has allowed me, for example, to go into the Celtic direction, which in a lot of ways it's been relatively unexplored in this context, at least. And we've got guys doing, you know, Slavic kind of stuff as well, which you could say the same thing. So it's kind of cool to see these kind of, some of the lesser known, lesser, well, at least, you know, in our spheres, lesser, explored, branches, Illyrian and, Daco-Thracian. We have some Albanians in our group and that sort of thing. It's pretty great. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah. As you mentioned about the Celtic stuff, you know, this is what I wanted to say about why I got so excited about the Sunriders, and there's a few other outfits that are now starting to crop up and stuff too. This is a trend that I said that we really needed for, like, years ago. I've been saying this. We need to redefine what academia means. We need to have our own in-house scholars and experts and people that discern the rules and not just necessarily the rules, but discern the elements and the meaning and the foundation of our own myth, our own sacred documents. You know, like, if you go to any other religion, say you went to Hinduism or any other religion, and you said, well, we rely on atheist academics that work in universities to tell us what to think about our own scripture, they would laugh. They would laugh in our faces, and they would think that we're nuts, right? Can you imagine saying that to the Hindus? Like, can you imagine, like, we got some sort of Swami or Acharya on here, and we said, oh, yeah, you have to listen to atheist academics in colleges in India. They would say that it's nuts. And that's something that has been going on in pagan spheres for years and years and years. But now with guys like this, with folks like the Sunriders and the Nerona Society, and there's a couple other ones out there that are starting to crop up, we're redefining, and we are saying this is for us, by us. We do this now. Because we are the true believers of it. You know what I mean? We actually believe this. Yeah. So if you can give us a kind of a rundown on how you came into Celtic stuff, because I get harassed at least once a week to talk about Celtic stuff, and I don't have any idea what I'm talking about. So let's get started with, how did you come to, you know, effectively paganism?
Yeah, for sure. Like I was telling you, I'm probably about half Irish American, and then half that's English and Scottish. So, and my father is Irish American. So that was just the more obvious direction for me to go. But at the same time, it was, you know, sort of the more difficult direction where, like you were saying, all the time you'll see Celtic guys that come into this, and they're looking around, and the Celtic stuff is very confusing and intimidating. There's not a good organization built up around it or structure, and it's very unclear, and it's just kind of a massive deterrent, where a lot of guys just kind of go toward the Germanic stuff, and a lot of Celtic guys are mixed with Germanic as well, like mm-hmm. myself. So it's totally understandable. But for myself, I had that kind of stronger pull in that direction. And also, that was just kind of, it was kind of exciting to dig it, to have something that was sort of mysterious and sort of a challenge to dig into. Sure. Originally coming into the generally this topic, I was watching Varg and STJ and stuff like that, and I ended up just like googling very Indo-European Discord server just randomly to see what would come up, and it led me to the Discord server that eventually developed into the Sunriders. So it was just kind of, you know, the normal thing in the last few years. This kind of thing has just been taking off. So I'm pretty new to all of it, and I've just kind of since then, I've just kind of, you know, getting into that group of guys and all the discussions we've had just has kind of pointed me in this direction. Like, there are these questions regarding mythology that just keep coming up, especially with Celtic stuff, that are just kind of like begging for answers. And, it's just kind of, I kind of became obsessed with that just based around just these ongoing discussions that with a bunch of guys, and we've all kind of like contributed, as, and like just built the theories up, in a way together. Yeah, that kind of sums it up, I guess.
Yeah, real quick, Sven, hello from Sweden. Hello to you, Alsa Heil, my friend. Much love to our Swedish brother. Svarin drops an ice cream on us. Much love, many blessings to Svarin. He also says, Celtic is full of New Agey Wiccan stuff, too. Most Wiccan and eclectic stuff like that is Celtic-based. And we talked about that before we went live. And this is kind of like, you know, a lot of Germanics have this like, visceral reaction when they hear or see or have to do, like, Celtic stuff gives them a visceral reaction, not because of the actual Celtic sources and beliefs, which we're going to get into today, but because of the people walking around today that say that they're Celtic. You know, you see the, what's that symbol, the trifecta symbol or something like that? Whenever you
The Triskelly?
Yeah.
Probably.
Triskella or something like that.
Yeah,
whatever.
Triskelion.
Yeah. When you see that thing, you usually see it on some tie-dye tapestry, and there's some fat pink-haired cat lady, and she's, you know, about to tell you some, you know, let's be honest, some pause stuff. It's going to be goofy. You know, it's just the epitome. Unfortunately, Celtic is what these people have really glommed onto, probably because of how kind of scattered and obscure a lot of the source material is. It gives them a lot of freedom to just make up a bunch of crap and inject their modern nonsense into it. They try to do it more in Germanic, but our stuff is a little bit more laid out, so they have a little bit more trouble. In Celtic, it's just they're like, this is a wide open area. We can just make up whatever we want here. You know, and now, guys that have been in the community for a long time have unfortunately developed, I don't want to say a gag reflex because that sounds awful, but a visceral reaction to the idea, like Celtic stuff, because they just, they're like, oh God, Celts, here comes the cat ladies. You know what I mean? And I want to break that apart and destroy it. So we're going to start this holy crusade against the LARPing Wiccan cat ladies tonight by letting you lay out what are the sources and the real stuff. And that's going to bring me to the next point, which is, what are the sources? I've been told that the sources were the Book of Invasions and like stuff like that. What are the good, legitimate Celtic sources?
Well, yeah, that's kind of one of the biggest challenges. And part of the challenge is that they are very scattered, and there are so many. Each one has a different complicated textual history and a lot of questions surrounding it. There's a lot of scholarly debate about every single one, you know, regarding the authenticity of it and what, you know, whether it reaches deep back in time or is a you know, recent fabrication or has been altered and that sort of thing. So it's, you know, I'm not a textual scholar where I can really go super deep into that question, but just can kind of pass along what I've seen basically. And the best answer I can give is that the Book of Invasions is an important source, but it is also has a lot of marks of being part of a constructed pseudo history, you know, connecting the Celts back to into the Christian narrative and various other classical Roman literature influences onto it and that sort of thing. Especially sort of the whole first portion of that book is in particular very questionable. And that doesn't mean there's not certain things buried in there that could be authentic or helpful. But they're, you know, that book depicts a series of invasions of groups of people, which tell a story in historical time that sort of builds up to the main Irish gods coming to Ireland and engaging in sort of the wars of the gods and there and other and other right? events. They're the Tuatha De Danann, one of the Tuatha De, let's see. So basically, that isn't one that it's not my favorite source because of that reason. And but there, then in the later portions of that book, you kind of once the identifiably real Celtic Irish gods arrive, it starts to, there's a lot more there that that can you can analyze and see if it's legitimate mythology and that sort of thing from different angles. And then you have one of the most important texts is the Cat Moytura, which is the Second Battle of Moytura, which is a it's a detailed version of one of the main battles of those Irish gods who arrive, and it has a complex relationship with the Book of Invasions as well, which you know, again, it's those are pretty deep topics that I won't really go into, but I'll just say that the Cat Moytura, Second Battle of Moytura, is a extremely important text overall. And then one of my favorites is the Wooing of Etain or Etain, or there's different pronunciations. I don't really know the correct pronunciation of Etain because I've heard it pronounced so many different ways, which is a prose bardic romance is how it's classified, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's a... Yeah, I don't really want to speak too much without having all the details in front of me about how you can classify these things in time exactly, because there's certain details, you know, that can be argued, you know, go back to the 600s, or a lot of the material is classified as, you know, material from the 800s that has been rewritten in, you know, the 1100s and put into a manuscript and that sort of thing. But those are, if you read the Second Battle of Moytura and Wooing of Etain, you'll have a big chunk of the mythology right there, actually, which, mm-hmm. and a lot of it's kind of buried and hard to figure out on first glance, but those are good places to start. And you know, there's just as far as I don't know if I'm answering the question fully, but sure. You know, there's a lot of different manuscripts, like the Book of Fermoy, the Yellow Book of Lecan, and all these kind of things you can go into. So it's a pretty broad topic, and I'm actually you know, I'm not an academic on this subject. But is there anything relating to that I can clarify?
What we can do is, I know you have a list of sources that you really recommend. What you can do, you've said it to me before, but if you want after the show, you could send it to me in Telegram and I'll post it on my Telegram thing. You go on which is t.me/primordialpath if anybody wants to.
Yeah,
that
makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is that these things are so scattered, you know, I usually just will like look at a single tale or text or whatever online, and you know, try to find the most authoritative version online, and compare different translations and that sort of thing. So it's really that can be really intimidating, and there really isn't a great just single collection in a single volume as far as the Irish myths comparable to the, you know, you can just buy the Poetic Edda or something like that. We usually kind of recommend just a straightforward collection, like Gods and Fighting Men is a good collection of the main Irish myths. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the tales there are abridgments and are not the most authoritative version. So it's just sort of an intro can get the ball rolling into a deeper study. And that's just kind of how it is right now. There isn't, you know, I just bought a brand new translation of the Cat Moitura that came out. I just bought it, and it's just one myth. Essentially, it's a, you know, like 50 pages long. And I just bought a book that's just that on by itself. And it's a very, you know, literalist translation of that. So it's, they're kind of scattered around, unfortunately.
And what was that book called again?
There's Gods and Fighting Men. It's a great, it's a collection that was, you know, William Butler Yeats wrote the preface to it and said it was, you know, one of the best books of his time, and he highly recommends it. So it's from back, you know, during the Celtic twilight of the late 19th and early 20th century. And it's a great, it has all the myths there, and you'll get the main stuff. And then the versions of the Cat Moitura and the Wooing of Etain that are in there, which are two of the most important ones, they're both abridgments. And so I have a copy of another book called Celtic Heroic Age by, one of the authors is John Carey, and I can't remember the other guy, but, and that has the full Wooing of Etain, as well as large sections, or maybe the whole Book of Invasions, Lavor Gavala Aaron, and lots of other texts relating to ancient Celtic culture and different mythological texts and poems and that sort of thing. So that's a good one to look into as well. That's a little more scholarly. It has a smaller selection of the actual mythic poems, but has some of them in a more full version. So
Gods and Fighting Men and Celtic Heroic Age.
Celtic Heroic Age, yeah.
So these are
a good
the two
combination
books
to get started, yeah.
To get started, very good. So speaking of getting started, one of the things that I get confused is the Celtic gods themselves. I've heard the names, I've read them on wikis and like stuff like that, but I'm not sure who are legitimate. And I also know that there's some differentiation between, say, like the Irish and the Welsh and these different cultures and stuff like that. So who is the pantheon, the Irish pantheon? I'm sure everybody's heard of the Dagda. Everybody's heard of Sir Nunos, and so. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people argue about the legitimacy of Sir Nunos and Dagda and some of these deities. Mm-hmm. So, if you could give us a brief overview of the pantheon, the Irish pantheon, or maybe even the Celtic pantheon, that would be really great.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, speaking of the Welsh, I also didn't mention that the Mabinogion is the main book to get for the Welsh myths, just as an addition to the other two books I mentioned. The Mabinogion Mabinogion would be the one you'll need to get for the Welsh myths. And, you know, a lot of them are in sort of the form of medieval romances. It's one of the latest, one of the later manuscripts, but you know, you can analyze it and there's definitely you can figure out the Welsh gods that are in there if you take a deep look. But in terms of Cernunnos, the horned god, Cernunnos is just a god that's known from inscriptions found, I think, mostly in Gaul, as far as I know. I'm not actually sure if there are any that appear in, like, in Britain or anywhere. But basically he's a very mysterious, and there's just a lot of conjecture about who Cernunnos is. There are a lot of Gaulish inscriptions to different deities that, you know, the names have been Latinized and that sort of thing. And the majority of the ones, well, I don't know. I can't really say the majority, but a lot of the inscriptions match up pretty easily with the deity names found in the Irish sources. So you can pretty much say that the majority of the names you see in the Irish sources are legitimate deity names. You know, you have Lugus is the same as the main Irish god Lu or L-U-G or L-U-G-H. And there's Nodens from Britain is the same as Nuada. all kinds of things. There's Ogmios from Gaul, and there's Ogma from Ireland in the Irish tales. And there's several others like that. And as far as Cernunnos, it doesn't have a clear match. And so there's a lot of theories that Cernunnos, you know, just means the horned one. And the idea is that this could be just an epithet, or it could be a local Gaulish name even. We don't really know. Or it could be an epithet that could apply to a god that we find in the Irish sources, such as the Dagda, or a Welsh god like Gwydion, which is a different god than the Dagda. Those are a couple of the possible theories that people have tried to connect Cernunnos to, because the Dagda, for instance, has an epithet that is, it's something regarding a man of peaks is what it translates as. And peaks can mean the points of an animal's horns or antlers, or it can mean the peaks, you know, any kind of peaks or angled peaks, basically. So some people try to say, oh, well, you know, the man of peaks is the man of horns, and he's Cernunnos by a different name. So there's a lot of theories on that, and I don't really take a strong stance on that. And I think Cernunnos has just been latched onto, especially in New Age stuff and Wiccanism. And I just kind of, it's not really central to you know, I'd be interested if somebody can figure out for sure who he is, but it doesn't make like a big impact on the stuff that I'm studying. And as far as the Dagda, his name means the good god. Da is a version of the word for god in Irish. In Old Irish, day is god, and or dia are versions of the word god. And so Dag means good in the sense of good, excellent, and Da means God. So he's the good or excellent God. And as far as what I've read about the scholarship on him, he's kind of one of the gods that's the most obviously described in the terms of a deity, where it's said that he controls the weather and performs various magical feats like that. So it's fairly obvious that he is a god, and you know, when you analyze him in terms of comparative mythology and stuff, he clearly fits in those terms. And he's usually interpreted as the sky father in some,
that's what I was about
some
to ask.
Sort of way. Yeah, definitely. And you know, I've interpreted him as sort of the sky father and wind god. And sure, he could have, you know, other aspects that he combines in that role as well. He's sort of a complex god, but that's the main thrust there.
Yeah. Well, we in the Germanic sphere, we don't differentiate between the sky father and the wind god, because our sky father is a wind god. You know,
Odin, exactly. Yeah.
You know, he rides Yggdrasil. He rides the wind. Yeah. You know, all that, we can talk about all that another time. But So, I've also read, I believe in one of your articles, you also mentioned a case for Lu being like the sky father, right?
Well, I don't think I've used the words sky father for him necessarily. Although, let's see, I may have just said, you know, there are different gods that are celestial or related to the sky. And I may have just been saying that that Lu is one of those. He has sort of part of the sky domain in a sense. Okay. I think that's what I said it's probably in the article on Dagda, sort of differentiating between Lu and Dagda, I connect Lu to the sort of Mitra deity in the Vedic sense, who, let's see, it's a complex, you know, there's a complex relationship between who is Mitra versus the sky father or father sky. So Lu would be sort of, he would be sort of a late coming God. He's the late coming God who sort of takes over and he rules in terms of justice and war. And he's connected to the early morning sky in particular, as well as just the daylit sky. He has a lot of different attributes that differentiate him from Father Sky himself, but he's,
would he be like a Balder?
Yes. This gets into really contentious territory, mm-hmm. where people have different interpretations. But that is, in my view, I follow the Dumuzil argument that Tyr is connected to Mitra, because I've found further evidence for that in the mythology of Mitra and the incarnation of Mitra. That to me, there's clear that, for example, the Tyr losing his hand to Fenrir, in my opinion, has a clear mythical parallel where the incarnation of Mitra, he is involved in the disarming of a powerful opponent during the war, where he is the god of truth and justice, essentially. And he helps his side gain the confidence of their one of their great opponents in the war. And they trick him, they trick their opponent into thinking that his son has been killed. And the incarnation of Mitra goes along with this ruse in a way where he himself doesn't tell a lie, but he participates in this sort of half truth to disarm their powerful opponent, who then they're able to, they kill him instead of, you know, just subduing him as in the case of Fenrir. And there's a lot more specific details to that, but their powerful opponent trusts the incarnation of Mitra because he's the one who doesn't tell lies and that sort of thing. So he's specifically trusted by this opponent, where, you know, Tyr is specifically trusted by Fenrir because he's gained his confidence growing up and that sort of thing. And so then they're able to disarm this opponent and they kill him. And as a result of simply participating in this ruse, the incarnation of Mitra, whose name is Yudhishthira, he had a chariot that would float six fingers above the ground as it rode around. It sort of was a floating chariot, and it was a symbol of his perfect truth and justice, because he was the god of truth and justice. And after he participates in this half truth, this sort of trick to disarm the opponent, this chariot now no longer floats. It just rides on the ground ever after as a symbol that he, you know, even the god of truth and justice has had to sacrifice, that thing that he is the exemplar of,
he loses his hand effectively.
He loses his floating chariot, whereas Tyr loses his hand, which is, you know, it's his pledge hand. Obviously, mm-hmm. he uses it in the pledge. It's a symbol of his fidelity and honesty, etc. And so Tyr loses his hand. The incarnation of Mitra loses his floating chariot, and it's just a symbol that, you know, in the great war, you know, for the greater good, even the perfect virtue has to be by the exemplar is compromised in this great battle. I think that's the way I see it. So to me, I interpret Tyr as Mitra, you know, based on a lot of other things as well. And then Balder, at least as far as Dumuzil argues, and again, this is very there's a million different theories, but he would be connected to the, you know, Tyr and Balder would be connected on a deep level, which just kind of shows in the fact that Balder has the courtroom of, where pure judgments are passed, but they aren't heeded. You know, if maybe you can remember the details of that, but Balder is connected to justice and court and that sort of thing, as well as his son, Frassetti, right? And so there's this sort of connection between this group of gods and justice and truth. And in Dumézil's argument, Baldur is connected to the god Ahriman, which is, he's, you know, his name, he's the god of the Aryans, and he's sort of the protector of the flourishing and success of the tribe, of the group, in that sense. And he is, in the Mahabharata, the incarnation of Mitra and the incarnation of Ahriman return to the same over deity, basically, when they die. They're sort of parts of one deity, so to speak. That, you know, they're separate, obviously, they have different functions as they manifest. But when the incarnation of Ahriman dies, he returns to the same parent deity that Yudhishthira had incarnated from as well. And when he dies, he says, "You and me are one." Basically, he says, "We are part of one."
So you're saying that Lu is effectively cognate to both Baldur and Tyr.
In a way, I think he's cognate to Tyr specifically, and that there's sort of some variability between which specific myths are attached to in different branches. You know, for example, the death of Baldur scene is attached. Mm-hmm. There's a similar scene. I think it's the same myth, but is a similar scene attached to the Welsh Lu, or Hle is how it's pronounced. But so there's just sort of a variability because of this connection. And the way I see it, I see sort of a circle around, you know, Tyr and Baldur, and there's some fluctuation between how the roles can be distributed. So I do usually say like, yeah, Lu, you can see Lu as Tyr and Baldur in a sense, but there's also a figure in the Irish sort of pseudo history layer of the myths called Ahriman. And there's been a lot of argument that Ahriman could be a remnant of Ahriman, actually. And you know, there's a lot of debate over the linguistics of that or the possibility of that, but so there could be sort of a remnant of the more direct cognate to Baldur, at least in my interpretation. And but as far as the myths that we have, Lu sort of takes the roles that I would see as, you know, belonging to Tyr and Baldur. Yeah.
Dang, that's a lot to unpack there.
It is. It's a lot, and I know a lot of people disagree on a lot of the details. So I'm just saying this is my opinion, and that's just how the field is, right?
Yeah. And so we are coming into the last half of the episode. So just to kind of do an overview, you would say Lu is a very important Tyr or Baldur like deity. Mm-hmm. You have the Dagda, who you would say is a very Odinic deity. Probably, would you say that he is like the father of the pantheon kind of thing?
Yeah, well, it's complex, and this is one of the interesting things about comparing Celtic to Germanic is that I just, you know, put out an article talking about how when you compare the Irish pantheon to the Germanic, it actually takes about, you know, six or seven gods to cover the mythic territory that Odin covers. So the Dagda would be one of those, most likely. And interestingly, also there are aspects of the Dagda which you would have to connect to Thor. So it's not a clean, especially in terms of the Dagda, it's not a clean, there's a lot of,
it's not one for one.
There's a lot of gods that are one for one, surprisingly, I think. It depends. There are some that are one for one, but in terms of the Dagda, you know, he's the giant with the that's very strong, and he has the comically large appetite and the club weapon and all these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So that you can see that just certain things are distributed differently. So, yeah, different roles are distributed differently.
If you could give us a like maybe a two or three examples of some deities you think are one for one between the Celtic and Germanic.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see. There's the god Ogma or Ogma.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if the G, I think the G is not pronounced, but he is the god of eloquence. He's also the guardian of the hall, etc. He's also the god of writing, but in my opinion, he's a one for one comparison to Bragi, and that's a pretty controversial one, I think, as Ogma has been compared to people like Hercules, gods like Hercules and. And it's kind of a mess, but yeah, in my opinion, he's a one for one with Bragi. And then, there's a god named Mithr. He's, in my opinion, he's a one for one, connection to Njörður.
Mm-hmm.
Although, yeah, let's see. Yeah, that would be correct, I think. And, Angus, he's, in my opinion, a one for one. And I was debating this the other day with William, of course. But in my opinion, he's a one for one comparison to Freyr. Then you have, Ivun, Skadi, and Gyrðir,
mm-hmm.
who I interpret as cognate directly to the consorts of you know, for example, Bragi and Freyr, and. And Odin in that role. So there are some that are one for one, and it obviously gets pretty complicated.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, I'm not an expert with this stuff, but Ogma or Oma, I actually felt that he was an Odinic figure.
Okay,
because I bring this up a lot because when I talk about the concept of Und and breath work and stuff like that, and Galdr, which is like something that it's one of my things that I specialize in. So we bring up the one of Odin's names, which is Ómi, and it means he who makes the beautiful sound, which I connect to, when Hindus say Om. Yeah, I mean it's like this. There's a lot of connections there. So when Ogma or Oma, I felt because he is a, from what I've read, he is a god that uses voice and he's a singing god and like all of these different things. I identified him as an Odinic figure, which it's kind of hard because it's like, as you mentioned earlier, like it's like all of the gods everywhere are Odinic cognates. Odin just covers so much. You know what I mean? But that was just kind of my opinion, just brushing past.
Yeah.
I'm not.
No, that's understandable. And, you know, there's obviously some overlap between Bragi and Odin in terms of, patronizing poetic skill and that sort of thing, right? In terms of Oma, the etymology connects him more to the act of, cutting the ohms into wood or stone. It's sort of, it comes back to
the runes
to furrows and rows and cutting rows and furrows. So it probably has a different etymology than Odin's name in that context. And also the Dagda, though, at least how I interpret it, being the wind god, he is connected to the life breath more directly, the way I see it, at least as I've argued it. And when I say that Bragi is a direct cognate of Oma, it's also based on their role in specific. There's this whole structure that I've kind of tried to point to of this repeating mythic pattern across all, most of the branches, where, in the Germanic, in the Norse myth, it would be Bragi being married to Ivun and Ivun being abducted and the golden apples followed by, Skadi and Njörður getting married and then Odin marrying Skadi in some versions after that. And then, the wooing of Gerther by Freyr and the Ysirvanir War. And this whole series of myths, it actually, if you dig into it, you have the same root figures performing similar roles in the Irish. And it's a bit too much to go into. But I just, you know, I'm sure people will be like, oh, like Oman and Bragi, he's just like making stuff up, but it's based on a specific structure of myths where Bragi being married to Idhun is paralleled by Oma being married to Etain, who is a key figure in the wooing of Etain cycle, which parallels that whole run of myths that I just talked about. So it's kind of, he has a specific role and I try to see it in sort of a structural way where it's not just like similar traits, but it's both similar traits and a connection to a structure of myth that you can kind of uncover. So anyway, there's a lot to argue.
Have you ever thought about,
No, that's fine.
Have you ever thought about putting like all of them in chronological order, like Mark Prier has with the Ostruetta?
Yeah, for sure. That'll be something to work on in the future, but it definitely needs to be laid out in that way, I think. And it would just even be interesting to lay them out and put it side by side with the Norse and, you know, the Vedic, et cetera.
Very cool. Real quick before we go on to the next topic, which is we're running out of time. That's going to be our last topic for this evening. But I got a quick question for my boy Svarin. He says, how and where do the Fomorian figure fit in? Do they battle the Irish gods? Are they comparable to the Jotnar or the Hrimthursar?
They're definitely comparable to the Jotnar. And I've just recently been sort of digging into the main Fomorian king and his son, which is Elatha and Bress. And Bress is the god who actually sparks the great war against the main, you know, the main gods of society, as I talk about them, the sort of protagonist gods. He's the main antagonist. He's portrayed fairly villainously in the Cap Moitura, there are competing traditions and manuscripts that show him in a much more positive light, where he is actually venerated and has all these positive qualities. But I've kind of showed that Bress and Elatha is sort of the ancestor figure of a lot of the Fomorians, but also the Tuatha De Danann, and Elatha has a myth which, you know, if we had time, I could do a reading or something, but I've posted it all over the place. It's just extremely close in its wording to it is the conception of Bress, his son, with the goddess Eriu. And this is extremely close in its form to the conception of the sun god, the sun god's son and reincarnation, essentially, in the Indian text, Srimad Devi Bhagavatam, I think it's called. I had been actually arguing that Bress is the Irish sun god, even though he's portrayed villainously in one of the texts for a while. There's a lot of evidence structurally pointing to this. He's sort of like you know, you could think of like Paris in the Iliad is his cognate as well. And this is sort of a degenerated form of the sun god as well, where, you know, the sun god is the archer as well as other things. He's the lover of the dawn goddess and all this stuff. And he's often on the side of the antagonists against the social gods. He's sort of an opponent that has to be, you know, overcome and united with or defeated in certain ways. He has a good side and a destructive side, as you can see with, you know, the sun can be can be cruel and inhospitable and cause drought and destruction. As it also has esoteric layers where the sun would draw souls to it as it went to the underworld, and it was one of the controllers of fate and time, the imposers of time and doom in that sense, as it, you know, goes through the sky. But anyway, so Bress is in this role that you can kind of track across into the Vedic and, you know, the Iliad, and even the Mithraic mysteries, where the god Mithras confronts the sun god and has to sort of overcome him and unite with him. With all that in place, then I found that the conception of Bress by Elatha is incredibly similar to the conception of Karna by the sun god Surya in the Vedic tradition. So what I'm saying is that in the Vedic version, it is the sun god, and he's having a son who is exactly like him. It's his own incarnation. And in the Irish version, you know, Elatha shows up and he's wearing gold and gold circlets around his neck and everything. And, you know, this is the thing with Irish stuff. They don't spell things out for you really, like who this is. But, the leading theory on Elatha was that he was a sun god. But no one could confirm it essentially. And, I had been saying, well, Bress has all these connections to the sun god Mithos, his son. And it didn't make sense to me that his father would also be the sun god. I was like, it doesn't make any sense, until I found this. And I'm like, well, it's the same thing, especially if you just see how close. It's just incredible that that specific passage has been preserved, and it just sort of matches almost phrase by phrase to the incarnation of the sun god by the elder sun god, you know, into his son. And so those are two of the main favorians to answer the original question. And so my argument would be that, you know, a lot of times the favorians are asocial forces or gods, which means they can be opponents that have to be overcome in a certain sense. You know, you can think of the Titans in Greek myth or whatever context you want to think of it in. But the gods who represent the forces of society and are fighting, you know, fighting to preserve society against, you know, the potentially destructive, more asocial forces, sometimes face off against the sun god in these different versions, at least. And I think that's what's happening with the favorians. And then, but also if you look at the Mahabharata version of this, the sun god and the demon of the last age are allied. You know, the sun god is an ideal, perfect friend, essentially, in the Mahabharata. He exemplifies loyalty and friendship and all these noble qualities, while also being sort of harsh and in certain ways. But he has allied himself because of basically because of his friendship and loyalty, the people who have supported him in the past in the story, and just based on how he was, his birth and that sort of thing, he becomes allied with the demon of the Dark Age, or the, you know, Kali, essentially the incarnation of Kali, Duryodhana, in the Mahabharata. These are the two sort of antagonists in the Mahabharata version of the Kurukshetra war. So, you know, the way I've been analyzing it is that the same things are happening across into the Irish myths. It's just incredibly similar when you dig into it. The Irish myths are repeating the same structures that I see, at least with the Kurukshetra war and that sort of thing. And so you can have both demonic forces on the side of the favorians, or just indifferent asocial, potentially destructive forces. Or you can have, you know, just very, you know, the sun god being just the most ambivalent god, essentially, who is both, you know, he starts off the myth being on the side of the gods of society and helping them win their war against the Firbolg, different set of opponents. And then he becomes king of the Tuatha Dé, but he is finally ejected from the kingship because he's too harsh and inhospitable. Especially, he's the inhospitable sun god, as you can imagine the sun in its inhospitable aspect. And then he, because he's angry about that, he starts the next war against the Tuatha De, and he now turns against them and has to be overcome as an opponent. So, yeah, it's a complex question as far as the Favorians, but I see that there could be sort of this mix of characters of deities and yeah, there's also a lot more that I haven't dug into in terms of all of who all of the specific Favorians are, but it's in my opinion, it's similar to the Jotnar, but I don't know. How do you see the Jotnar? Do you think it could match up in a similar way and have that kind of character? Or,
well,
I know we didn't quite debate that topic, but we kind of were talking about it a little bit.
Yeah.
Before.
That's a whole can of worms. Crack open about the thing is, my problem is I don't feel comfortable really digging into the Fomorians versus the Jotnar, because I don't know anything about the Fomorians. So I don't want to be out here just like, running my mouth. I can speak on it from a Germanic perspective, but as far as in the Celtic sphere, I don't know if they are. The way that you're describing it, it sounds like they are cognates to each other. And in that case, we could get into a big debate about whether or not they're good guys or bad guys or neutral guys or worthy of worship or so on and so forth.
Yeah.
That's a whole big debate. Well, unfortunately, we are running out of time. So
I'll just say this, that Baylor of the Evil Eye, he's one of the main Favorians, and he's very destructive. And in another myth, he's sort of in the place of Suttungr, of, the giant in the castle guarding, the princess, et cetera. And so Baylor, I would say he's a much more negative figure, which there isn't too much redeeming about him. But, I've compared, in my opinion, Uller is the cognate of Bress. So this is a whole nother thing you can get into in the future. But when Bress is born, his sun god father gives his mother a ring that will be given to he tells the mother of Bress, give this only to the man whom it will fit and no one else. And when Bress grows up, he's the only one that this ring will fit. And in my opinion, this is alluding indirectly to the fact that Bress is identical to his father. The ring that Elatha takes off his finger will only fit his son because he is identical to him. And there's all this other context which supports that. And so Bress is the sun god, known for his ring that's been given to him that signifies his solar quality. And there's a lot that I've also written about this, that, Uller is the very solar, he's the archer. His name, the root of his name connects him to shining splendor and glory, which is actually the same meaning as one of the Irish sun princesses, who's an explicit sun god, shining splendor and glory. So this is all these things which, and then Uller is, of course, the solar god who has the ring, famously. So anyway, a lot more you can go into with that. But there is, I know some people have at least argued that Uller could be part Jotnar, or I'm not really sure. That's a topic for the future.
Yes, sir. I'm very sorry, Gravy. I know you have you have all this stuff you want to talk about.
Once you get me going,
I know. Yeah. You did awesome, and we're going to have to save it for another time. We are running over time, which is okay. It's okay. We'll just have to do a part two, and with all the knowledge you have, we might have to do 10 parts. This guy over here.
That sounds good.
So, so in closing, Mr. O'Gravy, can you, first of all, I want to reiterate, Gods and Fighting Men, Celtic Heroic Age, and can you say the Welsh word for me again?
The Mabinogion.
Mabinogion are the three books you should pick up if you want to get into a Celtic myth and mythology that is recommended by Mr. O'Gravy here. He does excellent work over there on the Sunriders. Mr. O'Gravy, can you tell everybody where to find the Sunriders and find your work at?
So I think it's t.me/solarcult, if that sounds correct to you. I actually don't have it memorized, but t.me/solarcult, yeah, on Telegram.
On Telegram. So yeah, go to t.me/solarcult. It's Solar Cult with a C, right?
It is, yeah.
Solar Cult. It's S-O-L-A-R. C-U-L-T, at Solar Cult, or t.me/Solar Cult. Excellent articles, not just from Mr. O'Gravy, but they have a whole crew of characters over there that are all really, really smart and do really great work. Like Mr. O'Gravy said earlier in the show, they go all over the place, man. They're talking about Mediterranean stuff. They talk about some Slavic stuff. There is even our one boy in there. I don't know if he wants to be mentioned on air, but he does like Tengriism and talks about the steppe peoples. And there's some really, really cool stuff in there. So if you are like me and you really love this budding scholarship that is coming out of our communities, Sunriders, you're missing out. If you don't know about these guys, you're missing out. So go to t.me/solarcult and check them out. They also have some merch and stuff available too. So they're getting some t-shirts going. I know they have some bigger plans going on. So everybody go check them out. The Sunriders, t.me/solarcult. And if you like me, you like the Bog, you want to support the Bog, the boys are going to be back next week. You go to patreon.com/thebog and support us. There is a tier for everybody, man. $5 all the way up to $50. You can get all of our exclusive content, which is going to be, I got Bog Lord Radio. I'm doing Bog Lord Radio. It's just me and you. It's just like the old times. Dave on the mic, you guys, me. It's like ladies' night, except without the ladies, just the Bog Lords. So I guess it's not like ladies' night at all. It's just my podcast. But anyway, there's my podcast. There's also Valor Hall from Mr. Wolfman. There's stuff by Tristan. All of us do have our own little individual projects. Tons of exclusive content over there. And also, most importantly, you can get the Bog itself, the mothership, on audio, on RSS feed. It loads right onto your app on your phone, so you can listen to it in your car, at work, at the gym, or on your commutes. And support us, man. $5 all the way up to $50. There's a tier for everybody. Really good stuff. Also, you get like a mug and a sticker and stuff for certain tiers. And then also, if you want to support us with something else, go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and get some sweet Bog merch. And on top of all that stuff, make sure to go to facebook.com/ironagejodish. You can see the top left corner of the screen, facebook.com/ironagejodish, to check out some authentic Vedic astrology. You're missing out if you haven't seen it. If you want to check out more, you can check out some of the podcasts that we did. We did some episodes where we interviewed Mr. Neil John from the Iron Age Jyotish. Excellent, excellent stuff. If you decide to get a birth chart, if you decide to get some services from Mr. Neil John, which I know you're going to love, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. So go to facebook.com/ironagejyotish and check that out. But like always, guys, I'm going to raise the horn to our most beloved, exalted patrons, our very own Andre, House Allen, and Mr. Corey. Alsa Heil, much love and many blessings to each and every one of you. Helgaveteto Kindrale Ilska. Hail. All right, that's going to be it for tonight, guys. Let's check you guys next week, next Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell, or go over to Dave Martell YouTube channel to get every single episode on the Bog playlist after we're all over. So much love, many blessings, and hail to all the Bog Lords and Bog Maidens.